In the short term, we, you know, for the most part, we have to accept the fact that these processes are occurring, and so it's not a case of stopping the slopes from failing. It's actually a case of controlling where the debris goes or where the assets are located that might be in the way of things. So, I mean, a really interesting example of this occurred in the high altitude mountains of northern India in February of this year, where a really large block, you know, something the size of, if you think about a block the size of Wembley Stadium, it's around about that size block, came off the high mountain and fell over 1,000 meters vertically down, and then hit the valley floor and fragmented and turned into a rock avalanche. As this mass then went down the slope, it picked up snow and ice along the way, which melted, and so it turned into a debris flow.
That was Dave Petley, Pro Vice Chancellor at the University of Sheffield. Dave's a geographer, earth scientist, and a global expert in slopes and landslides. More coming up after this message from our sponsors.
Central Piling are proud to sponsor the Breaking Ground podcast. It aligns with our goals of providing technical expertise, continuous improvement, and community engagement. These are things we've been striving for since our inception over 40 years ago. Some of the engineering achievements during that time include the design and construction of the foundations for West London's tallest residential building, complex 3D finite element analysis to facilitate the creation of a triple story basement, and damage impact assessments for underground assets on a rotary cased piling contract. Our plant includes a wide range of bored piling machine sizes. These are continually being updated to ensure emission regulation, compliance and efficiency. We're also able to offer driven precast and steel piling on selected contracts. Learn more about what we do and discover details of how we might be able to help you on your next foundation or retaining wall scheme, visit centralpiling.com.
Hi Dave, thanks for joining us on the Breaking Ground podcast. How are you?
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's really, really great to see you. Are you a fan of podcasts?
I am, actually. It's interesting. Over the years, I've moved from listening to music to listening more and more to the spoken word, both Radio 4 and podcasts. So actually, it's been quite a change in my life. And I really, really enjoy it. I find I learn a lot.
Oh, cool. Any recommendations for us?
I think there's just so much out there that, it's so varied, isn't it? It's terrific.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I enjoy immersing myself in the conversations and learning new things. I think as engineers, we've got to carry on with our CPD, and I think it's a really good way to do that. There's, of course, the ICE have got a podcast. I picked up on one. There's the Tunneling Society have got one as well, which is quite a different format to what we do here. It seemed to be almost like an audiobook, a story, rather than the sorts of conversations that we have here. But it was entertaining and in a really different sort of way, but also educational. So Dave, you're an expert in landslides and slope stability, working at the University of Sheffield, and you're gonna tell me some of the things that I've forgotten from my days at university and the slope stability, and also bringing us up to date with current world events and the impacts of climate change. But let's start by looking at some of the concepts of slope stability. And this might be a bit of a challenge, because I guess you're used to working with it won't be a blackboard, but whatever you do, writing down equations. I'm going to ask you to explain how slopes work in the simplest way possible by describing some of the mechanisms. And I suppose the most common area of slope failure in the UK, certainly in the part of the world that I am, which is Essex, is clay slopes and slip circles. Can you explain to me a little bit about how they develop, what the equilibrium point is clay slopes?
I mean, it's probably good to start just by talking about definitions. So, you know, when we talk about landslides and mm-hmm. slopes, and what we're talking about in terms of a landslide is the collapse of a slope. And I think it's really important to remember that although, you know, we talk a great deal about the human role in causing slopes to collapse, to form landslides, it's an entirely natural process. So we would be seeing landslides in the natural world whether humans were there or not. The key thing to bear in mind is that there are really two most important natural mechanisms for making slopes fail to collapse. I mean, one is essentially the action of water, and many people will remember the concept of effective stress, which is the idea that as a slope becomes more saturated, and in this case, we're usually talking about saturation from the bottom up. So, you know, heavy rainfall permeates into the ground, the water starts to pond at the bottom of, or lower down in the slope, and then the groundwater level rises. As that saturation level develops, the grains effectively feel a buoyancy force. And that buoyancy force is the change in, we call effective stress. And that change in the effective stress is essentially reducing the amount of friction between the grains. And the kind of key concept we then need to think about is that what's holding the slope up is friction, either on the sheer surface or between the grains, if it's a flow. And what is trying to collapse the slope is shear stress. And at the point where the shear stress becomes greater than the retaining force, the friction, then that's the point where the slope will start to move. So essentially what we see in most or many slopes is the idea that the groundwater level is rising, the effective stress is changing, and that means that the resistance to friction is reducing. And when the resistance to friction becomes less than the shear stress, then the slope starts to move.
In a clay situation, in the short term at least, it's a total stress, as in you've got a cohesion. The groundwater, initially at least, it's not present, is it? And therefore, that's why you see going around the country quite steep slopes. Probably on a construction site, you've got a cut in, it might be 45 degrees or even steeper. That's okay for a period of time.
Yes, that's right, because the second, you know, really important concept to remember here, well, two concepts really. One is cohesion. So you know, that's the interparticle bonding that is essentially adding to the frictional strength. And essentially, as the cohesion becomes higher, the slope is more stable. And the second element is the idea of suction. So within, for example, clay slopes, we typically get suction forces within the pore spaces, and those suction forces are actually adding to the strength of the slope, and so allow it to be more stable. So clearly, as the groundwater level rises, then essentially what we're losing is we're losing those suction forces as well as the frictional strength.
But there would be no an area of good London clay, for instance, there would initially at least be no water table, at least not, so it could be 30, 40 metres down or more. But something changes within the clay, doesn't it? The pore water pressures dissipate and drainage starts to occur within the clay.
If you take a typical cutting, for example, after the slope has been cut, the groundwater conditions are out of equilibrium, and it actually takes quite a long time for the groundwater level, especially in the clay where the permeability is low, it takes quite a long time for the groundwater level to come back up to an equilibrium state. So, you know, after a cutting has been created, there's years, maybe decades in which the groundwater level is re-equalizing, or re-equilibrating, and therefore, you know, potentially the stability is declining over quite a long period of time. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, we continue to see failures in clay cuttings that, you know, were built tens and sometimes many tens of years ago, because the groundwater is still responding now to the initial cutting that was undertaken.
That does make it difficult for somebody that maybe is a temporary works designer to try and assess, well, how long have I got? How long have I got before that clay slope really starts changing in behaviour and has some drained, an effective cohesion, effective angle of friction, and therefore I need to batter it back further or create an exclusion zone. What advice would you give to temporary works designers? How much should they be downrating the cohesion, you know, the measured cohesion from a triaxial test result? If I've got a cut in that I'm going to have for an excavation that's going to be there for 6 months, can I take 100% of the value? Do I need to take 50% of the value? Is there any sort of guidance out there?
There is guidance out there. I'm going to be very cautious in my response to you because I'm not a chartered engineer, And therefore, I don't think it's appropriate for me to provide guidance to chartered engineers as to how they should treat those sort of parameters.
I'd like to say we're not recording this, but clearly we are. So there might be a few people that go back to it. But I suppose go to somebody that is experienced in that field. We've spoken very briefly on this podcast before about the Register of Ground Engineering Professionals. I think even within that, you need to look into what specialisms do people do. You know, I'm great at designing piles and retaining walls. I'm not so good at designing slopes. And you do really need to understand exactly what is going on with that specialist area. So thank you for your candor in that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things is that, I mean, certainly if we're talking about sort of slopes in the UK, I mean, you know, there's many, many decades of experience of how these systems work practically. So that, you know, you can call on both the kind of formal guidance, you know, the Eurocodes, etc. But there's also a great deal of experience in just, you know, working with these slopes through time. So you know, I think it wouldn't be right for me as a geologist to give advice on these sorts of issues. There's plenty of advice out there.
Yeah, well, let's talk more generally about perhaps mitigation measures when we're looking at slopes. Because there are things you can do to mean that you've got more of a factor of safety against a slope failure. And one thing that occurs to me is making sure that there's no surcharge at the top. So you might have an area at the top of the bank, for instance, where we can exclude any site traffic or we can stop material being left at the top. And that is completely applicable to the calculations, and it changes where the slip circles would apply, if people can remember the slip circles from their uni days. And of course, drainage as well. I mean, could you perhaps talk us through why drainage would be useful? I mean, when I think in terms of clay, sorry, it's the material, the ground, the soil that I'm most used to. We want it to be undrained. So why stick a drain in there? Surely that doesn't help.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, you know, we're going back to the concept of effective stress. So, you know, we're trying to retain a situation in which we keep the effective stress in the slope, you know, at a level that we're comfortable with. And the best way to do that is to draw down pore water pressures. So the drainage is effectively a way of managing the pore water pressures within the slope. I mean, that, you know, that point about surcharge is a really interesting one. There was a really fascinating example of that in Yorkshire about 7 or so years ago, where it was at a place called Hatfield Stainforth. People may remember it, which was an open cast coal mine site with a railway line going along the outside of the location. And the mining company there were dumping spoil on the side of the track, and they had a really substantial failure because of the loading on the spoil heap, which drove a slip surface that went through the underlying strata and failed through underneath the railway track, so uplifted the track through the rotation. And that was a case where, you know, the underlying materials were clays and silts and gravels. They were saturated, and the surcharge that they put on the spoil heap then drove the failure of the ground. A really good example of the role of surcharge and the management of it.
Yeah, there has been some dramatic failures over the years. Probably the most prominent one in the public consciousness, at least, is the Aberfan disaster, which was a colliery in Wales, and it was a tip of I don't know what the material was, but obviously it failed and it came down killing a lot of children. Can you explain a little bit more about
Aberfan is the landslide disaster that most people in the UK remember. And we just passed the 55th anniversary of it, actually, just a few weeks ago. So Aberfan is interesting from the perspective of both the things that we've been discussing. So Aberfan was a natural slope where before the spoil was tipped on the slope, no work had been done to remove the superficial materials. And there was a failure to recognise the fact that there were a set of natural springs discharging onto the slope. even though they're very clearly mapped on the Ordnance Survey maps of the time. You can go back to those map archive and you can see the springs marked. And so spoil was being tipped by a conveyor, essentially. So they had a conveyor up onto the slope, and they were tipping spoil with no compaction, just free tipping onto a series of spoil heaps on the valley wall. And over time, they built up a really substantial volume of colliery waste that was obviously being saturated by the springs. In fact, they had a number of failures in that material prior to the events of the tragic day. And in fact, there were a number of other flow slides in colliery material elsewhere in South Wales. So really, the signs were not observed that were indicating that there was a significant problem. On the day of the failure, very, very early in the morning, the tipping crew got up to the top of the slope and noticed that there was deformation occurring, and in fact reported back down to the colliery that there was a problem developing. But the communication lines, the telephone lines, were broken, so they actually had to send someone down on foot. And as that person was going down the slope, there was a rotational failure in the spoil that then went through a static liquefaction process. So the spoil effectively fluidized and turned into a flow slide, highly, highly saturated material. And so, you know, a very rapid and fast run out, and it directly in line was the school. And just under 150 people were killed, 120 or so of whom were children. And the school was literally buried by the spoil. So, you know, there's a number of lessons from it. I mean, a whole series of lessons, actually. But one was about seeing sequences of previous events and recognising the risk from that, which they failed to do. And the second was the danger of kind of free tipping with no control. And then the third was failing to recognise that there was a problem with water management on the slope.
So presumably the material that was being tipped was superficial material, as though the miners were trying to get to the coal. It was the material that lay above it and was of no use.
Yes, I mean, this was typical colliery spoil. You know, these are underground pits, you know, obviously, so it's a mixture of kind of clays and sandstones with quite a lot of coal residue mixed into it. So if you imagine that the debris was this awful, they call slush, actually, of clay and bits of rock and sand and colliery waste. I mean, interestingly, when the slide stopped moving, it actually drained pretty quickly. So although it was very mobile at the time that it hit the school, on completion of movement, it drained out quite fast and therefore became a solid mass. And I mean, there's lots of pictures, they're pretty harrowing, of the miners from the colliery, you know, digging through these piles of debris that have buried the school, and obviously trying to recover their own children. It's the most desperate story.
Yeah, it must have been completely devastating for the area. I don't know how they recovered.
Never did, you know. And you can visit the site now. There's a memorial garden, and you can visit the graveyard. It's if ever you want a reminder of why we need to manage slips properly, that's the one.
Yeah. So the water, it sat on effectively, it became the failure surface. So there was there an impermeable layer then, and that's why it all started flowing?
Yeah, so I mean, the water was being fed into the bottom of the slide, of the spoil heap. And so the water table was rising, being fed by these springs underneath, and this kind of completely unsorted colliery waste. So it was a case of incredibly poor practice, and there's an absolute tribunal, the public inquiry report is online. It's absolutely devastating about the way that the site was being managed.
Yeah,
it's a really interesting read, but it's incredibly critical.
And was it subsequently found that there were other places like this that. Or maybe we've still got them. Hopefully not.
That's actually a really interesting question, Steve. So, you know, the investigation found that there were other sites that were dangerous, and over the subsequent decade or so, there was quite a big program of removal of spoil heaps from the South Wales slopes. However, there is quite a lot of colliery waste still left in tips. And I think 2 years ago, in one of the big storms that we had, actually a little bit less than 2 years ago. So I think in early 2020, there was a big storm came through South Wales, and there was another failure in a waste coal waste tip. It was actually caught on a video you can view on YouTube. It's quite interesting to see. It was nothing like the scale of Aberfan, but that did drive a concern really about the possibility that there was a residual problem in the actually very large numbers of residual coal waste tips in South Wales. Quite a lot of work has been done over the last 18 months or so to try to understand the magnitude of the problem. And the Welsh government released the results of that maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. And they found that in fact, there hadn't been a registry of these sites. So they're poorly managed.
Yeah.
That many of them are sitting on private land. And so there's lots of landowners who own these things, but perhaps aren't aware of the need to manage them properly. And that there's a need now to do a program of both, you know, risk mapping across them and making some of them safe. And that's at least in part because of the potential impacts of climate change. You know, as the climate is getting wetter, there's a greater sense that there may be failures. It's also probably in part because the material within these piles is deteriorating with time and therefore weakening, and therefore there's a greater chance for failure. The Welsh government believes that the cost of mitigation is £500 million.
Okay.
And the question now is who's going to pay for it? With the Welsh government arguing that because the coal was extracted for the national benefit, that it should be a UK government problem, and the UK government taking the view that this is a devolved responsibility, so it's a Welsh government problem. So there's quite a standoff occurring at the moment about who is responsible.
It's a political storm. I was up in Bangor last year, early this year, and did the Zip World. I don't know if you've been there, Dave. So this is the zip line across the old colliery. Fantastic experience, but it gave me a sense of the scale of these places. And so £500 million, it doesn't seem a big number when you consider you've got a multiple of these sorts of places around Wales. One thing I did notice, there was lots of cuts in the slope, which presumably had been done to reduce the maybe it was partly for access, but also to reduce the potential for slope failures.
Yeah, that's right. So benching is in extractive situations is a standard way of managing slope stability and very successful. Actually, it reduces the likelihood of failures.
Just back to we were talking about drainage earlier, and there's various different forms of it. One would be to have a surface drains, which would certainly help if you had a tension crack, and it would take the hydrostatic force away from the crack and reduce the likelihood of failure. But I was also reading up when I was doing my research on counterfort drains. Is that a technique you're familiar with?
Yeah, I mean, very widely used, very successful, it's all about basically managing the water and trying to draw the groundwater level down. In the majority of cases, water is coming into the slope either through surface infiltration. And so, you know, if you can extract the water from the surface and get it off the slope quickly, that's effective. Or it's coming from, you know, surrounding slopes. So drains that basically sit around the outside of the site are also a very effective way of getting the water out of the slope. And in most slope situations, the two kind of key ways of dealing with the problem are profiling, you know, so essentially to manage the slope gradient, and secondly to bring the groundwater level down through effective drainage.
So the counterfort drain itself, that's a trench sort of going perpendicular to the direction of the slope, and then you've got drains coming off the
coming
trench.
Off, that's right. It's kind of herringbone pattern up the slope.
Yeah. Okay. And so would you have to use like a tunnel boring type technique to connect those drains to the trench, or would you just do a vertical dig and drop it in?
I mean, different situations demand different approaches. So, you know, either are widely used. I mean, very often because of cost, it's backfield trenches. But in some situations, example, in Hong Kong, you know, subsurface drains is often the preferred approach.
Yeah, it did strike me that the temporary works involved to come up with some of these remedial solutions might in themselves instigate failures because of the weight of the plant that you got sat there and they're like the holes that you're creating. It does seem fraught with difficulty. We talked at the outset about the impact of climate change, and obviously it's fresh in our minds from COP26. Could you explain why climate change? And we're talking about increased CO2 and methane leading to the warming of the planet. Why is global warming going to be leading to more problems with slopes?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complex problem, and actually it takes quite a complex answer. So the most simple mechanism that's causing us concern is that there's very, very good evidence from multiple locations around the world, including the UK, that increased air temperatures is driving increased amounts of water vapor. So essentially warm air can hold greater levels of moisture. And the consequence of that is that peak rainfall intensities are increasing. So actually slopes are very, very sensitive. When they get close to their equilibrium point, you know, close to a factor of safety of one, they're very, very sensitive to the amount of water coming in. So as we increase the peak rainfall intensities, and that's what's happening around the world, we take more and more slopes to a factor of safety of one and trigger failure. And of course we're seeing that in the UK. You know, I mean, everyone has observed these extraordinary rainfall events that we get, you know, quite frequently now, where total rainfall or hourly rainfall are higher than we can remember. And so that's the first mechanism and the most important one. The second thing is that at a kind of continental or global scale, we're seeing quite substantial changes in the way that the atmospheric systems are operating. And again, we see this. So one example of this is that the jet stream, so the high altitude rivers of air that we benefit from when we're flying on our holidays, jet streams are changing. And in particular, the jet stream is becoming more sinuous. So it's becoming more kind of kinked in the way it behaves. And that's important because low pressure systems, Atlantic low pressure systems in the case of the UK, often form when the jet stream has these big bends in them. So, you know, when we get these successions of big low pressure systems that we sometimes get now, that's often because the jet stream out in the Atlantic has a big meander in it. And it's in the heart of that meander that the low pressure systems are forming. So what we're now seeing is these bigger than we've seen before low pressure systems coming in a succession of events, bringing really heavy rainfall, and we might get one, and then a few days later another, and a few days later another. And of course, what that's doing is it's generating these very high rainfall intensities in situations where the ground is already saturated. So that's the second thing.
And it can be very localized as well, I suppose, in areas that it's not been used to it.
That's exactly right. And then I think the third, certainly on a global scale, that's really important, that's just worth bearing in mind, is the effect of, you know, the kind of counterpoint to the fact that we get these really prolonged periods of wet weather is that we're also getting, because of the way that these global scale atmospheric systems are working, you also get these really prolonged periods of very dry weather. And, you know, we all remember the start of lockdown last year, where we, you know, we were blessed with this period of, for a springtime, extraordinarily dry weather. Mm. And it was, you know, it was the one sort of saving grace of that period, was that the weather was so good. Well, that's you know, that's the atmospheric system working in reverse, you know, so you're getting these kind of prolonged droughts. And that's really important for two reasons. I mean, one is the most important is that these periods of droughts are then driving periods of wildfires. That's true in the UK. It's particularly true in some overseas locations. California is being affected this way. Parts of Canada, parts of Russia, Australia, etc. And that's removing natural vegetation and changing the ability of the slopes to deal with water. And so there's a kind of long-term effect that's occurring there. And then a second effect is that we see ground cracking, and the opening up of ground cracks. And of course, that ground cracking is a mechanism that weakens the slope, and when we have the heavy rainfall, allows water to infiltrate easily.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, the freeze-thaw action as well would contribute to it. There's a lot of slopes higher up that would have a permafrost, which presumably now is melting, and that's got to have an impact as well, isn't it?
Yeah. So you then get the sort of specialised environments where you have a different set of effects. So one, I'll come back to in a moment, is high mountains. Another is coastal environments where in coasts we're seeing the effects of sea level rise. So that means that the waves are spending more time at the bottom of slopes and eroding them faster. But in conditions of climate change, we're also seeing a more stormy environment. So we're seeing bigger waves and obviously more rainfall. So coastal landslides are becoming more active. Rates of coastal erosion are increasing. And of course, the primary mechanism is actually shallow landsliding for the coast to retreat. And that, that's having a profound implication for people who live, for example, on the East Coast.
Because it's wearing away that toe of the slope, and therefore it completely changes that calculation we were talking about and the equilibrium. And there's nothing there to hold it back. I suppose you could actually get a very shallow rotational failure by the toe, followed by a deeper slip circle.
That's right. Or you might get a rotational failure higher up on the slope, with the material then going through a sort of static liquefaction or a weathering process that then allows it to turn into a flow. So in coastal environments, this is a really substantial problem. Really substantial problem.
Yeah.
We're trying to understand, as we see, because we now have substantial amounts of warming still to come that are baked into the system, and of course sea level rise is accelerating. So it's a kind of interesting research problem to understand, what is the likely rate of coastal erosion in 50 years' time or 100 years' time?
Yeah, because you mentioned about it failing at the top. Once that soil has failed once, it's then got different properties and presumably more susceptible to failing again with another change further down the line. It's a vicious cycle to get into, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. So you've probably gone from a peak strength to a residual strength situation. So the cohesion has gone. So the material is now weaker. It typically breaks up and weathers as well, and so becomes weaker. So once failure is initiated, especially when you've got waves at the bottom of the cliff, its resistance is low. The high mountain environment that you mentioned is you're absolutely spot on. So high mountain rocks have had a pretty hard life, probably formed on the seabed, went to some significant depth in order to lithify, and then in the tectonic collision have been lifted up, maybe 10 kilometers from where it was originally located into the high mountain setting. Along the way, those rocks have suffered a lot of earthquake activity, because that's the tectonics that's brought it up there. So typically when they get up to a high altitude, In most mountain chains, they're pretty fractured and damaged, but up there conditions are pretty cold and wet, and the consequence is that the rocks are basically full of permafrost, and so we're kind of glued together by ice. In conditions of climate change, that ice is deteriorating. So what we're now seeing is really substantial increases in the rate of rock fall activity. Up at high altitude, especially in the spring and on in the northern hemisphere on south facing slopes where there's a lot of solar radiation coming in. So there's some really, really good quantitative studies which are measuring over a long period of time the rate of rock fall activity up in the high altitude. And it's demonstrably true that it's increasing as climate change kicks in.
Right. And what can we do about that? If it's impacting on people, what remedial activity or preemptive activity to reduce the impact? We've spoken about drainage, but with with rock, I guess it's not as easy to have deep drainage. I suppose we could have rock bolts in certain situations.
I mean, it depends on the setting, Steve. You know, in many cases, the slopes that we're talking about are so large and so high that there's actually very little mitigation that we can put in place in situ. I mean, of course, the most important mitigation that we can actually undertake at this stage is to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we're producing. I mean, ultimately, that's the mitigation that we need to be thinking about in the long term. In the short term, we, you know, for the most part, we have to accept the fact that these processes are occurring, and so it's not a case of stopping the slopes from failing. It's actually a case of controlling where the debris goes or where the assets are located that might be in the way of things. So, I mean, a really interesting example of this occurred in the high altitude mountains of northern India in February of this year, where a really large block, you know, something the size of, if you think about a block the size of Wembley Stadium, it's around about that size block, came off the high mountain and fell over 1,000 meters vertically down, and then hit the valley floor and fragmented and turned into a rock avalanche. As this mass then went down the slope, it picked up snow and ice along the way, which melted, and so it turned into a debris flow. And further down the valley, you know, 15 or so kilometers down, there were two hydroelectric schemes being under construction, and both of them were struck by this flow as it went through. There are some videos online. It's called Chimoli if you want to see it. And both of these schemes were extremely badly damaged, and there were about 200 people killed as well at this site. And that, I mean, it was a terrible disaster and very dramatic event. But that was a case where, you know, these sort of large rock slope collapses in high mountains, they're a natural process that's been really accelerated by humans. And we can't stop them from happening. You know, they're going to happen. There's no mitigation. So really, we should be thinking in terms of where we're going to locate this infrastructure as to whether those sites are going to be safe. And yeah, if you think that the design life for a hydroelectric scheme like that might be 50 years or so, and there's a whole, you know, whole valley system upslope of it, it's actually entirely reasonable to think that such an event was going to come through and hit these schemes sooner or later. So it's one of these cases, yeah, where we actually really need to kind of adjust our normal as to the way we're thinking about these events because of climate change.
I think we're going to have to put a warning on this podcast because it's going to give people nightmares. It feels like a bit of a disaster movie we're talking about. It's clearly had a dramatic and disastrous effect on people already around the world. I remember reading a few years ago about there's a rock in, I think it was the Canary Islands, that people were concerned about falling into the Atlantic Ocean and causing a tsunami. Are we talking?
Well, I can put your
risk on that scale as well.
Well, I can put your mind at rest on that one.
Go ahead. Good. I'll get my holiday booked up.
That's right. So this is
Tenerife.
This is the island of La Palma, which is the island that actually has the volcanic eruption that's occurring right now. So if you've seen those amazing pictures of the volcanic eruption, that is La Palma, in which this hypothesis was presented. So the idea on La Palma was that the flank of the volcano is unstable, and that sooner or later it would fail. The block that potentially would fail would be around about, these numbers are extraordinary, but around about 500 cubic kilometers of rock would come off the side of this volcano, and it would fail in one big landslide. And if you were to move rapidly a block that size into the ocean, you would generate a huge tsunami. And the worry that was presented was that tsunami would then spread across the Atlantic, and it would generate.
Give us the good news, quick!
But the good news is that that it's not really a likely scenario. So it is a case where it is just about credible that you could have it happen, but it's incredibly unlikely to happen like that. You know, big landslides do come off the side of volcanic islands. That's true. We see the evidence of it, but almost certainly when they happen, they occur in a series of slices rather than in one big block. And if you have a series of slices, then the likelihood is that the tsunami that you would generate would be much, much smaller.
Just a little tsunami. I'll get the surfboard out then.
Yeah, that's right. and then the other thing to remember is that at a continental scale, actually a landslide is a point source of a tsunami, unlike a fault, which is a line source. And because it's a point source, of course, as the waves radiate out, they lose energy very significantly. So the consequence is the vast majority of scientists don't think that this is a substantial risk. And there's no real concern as this current volcanic eruption is going on that there's instability in the flank. The good news also is that as this big eruption has been occurring, there's no sign that the volcanic island is unstable. And even though this hypothesis was presented 20 years ago, we can't find mega tsunami deposits around most ocean basins, which suggests they're not normal. Against all the examples I've given you of disasters, this is one where we don't think that this is a substantial risk of any type at all. So you can go on your holiday with no great concern. And if you live on the south coast, we don't think you're at risk.
All right. Well, I'll still try and avoid some slopes, as we might have other issues with rock falls. What about earthquakes? We touched on it there. There's been issues in China and Pakistan that I know you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, so I think one of the things we've become much more aware of over the last 20 years or so is that when there are big earthquakes in mountain chains, then landslides are a really substantial part of the risk. You know, earthquake scientists, earthquake engineers have always said it isn't earthquakes that kill people, it's buildings that kill people. I think we probably modify that now to say, well, slopes can be pretty dangerous things too. And essentially, you know, the shaking changes the stress state temporarily in the slope, and lots of slopes exceed their factor of safety under those conditions, in part because, you know, the shear stress has changed, in part because the normal stress has changed, you know, according to whether the shaking is horizontal or vertical, some combination of the two. So I think this really first came to most people's attention in about 1999, when there was a big earthquake in Taiwan, where we saw really very large numbers of landslides. And then in both the 2005 Pakistan earthquake and the 2008 China earthquake, both of which happened in high mountain areas, we saw literally hundreds of thousands of landslides being triggered in the 30 or so seconds of shaking. You know, and the effect of those landslides was to cause enormous amounts of infrastructure damage, which was a major part of the loss, but it also, you know, dramatically influenced our ability to respond to the disaster. So, you know, people were trapped, but the roads were closed by landslides. So I think there's a recognition now that in areas where there is high levels of seismicity, designing very careful design to make sure that the earthquake shaking is taken into consideration has become a really major part of our work.
Yeah, well, one thing that strikes me about seismology, we don't seem to have really got any better over the years of predicting where and when an earthquake is going to happen. We're pretty good at looking at it after the event, but trying to predict where the next big earthquake is going to occur seems to elude scientists. Maybe I'm doing them an injustice. And therefore, trying to manage our urban environments around that becomes very problematic. What would you say to that, Dave?
Well, I mean, you're right, certainly on prediction. I mean, a lot of seismologists will argue that earthquake prediction is literally impossible. Predicting the, you know, time and location of an earthquake is something that we'll probably never be able to do, and that's because the fault of the behavior of earthquake faults is chaotic and therefore is not predictable. And actually, whilst there are still people who are working on prediction of earthquakes in terms of time and space, there's no evidence at all of any advance that's going to make a substantial difference in that area. But what we can do is to assess seismic hazard and risk. So although we may not be able to say that we're going to have a particular earthquake in a particular location, we can say that over a 100-year period, there's a, you know, 40% chance that we're going to get an earthquake that's greater than this magnitude in this area. And of course, that then, if the system is working properly, allows sensible design. So if through understanding the seismic hazard, we have made really substantial advances in that. We know that in the design life of a building or a bridge or whatever, you know, there's a 20% chance that it's going to have to stand up to an earthquake, you know, a peak ground acceleration of, you know, of so much, then that's something that we can then can build into design. And so really a lot of the focus is not really on trying to anticipate a particular event. It's trying to anticipate the likely peak ground accelerations that the structure is likely to encounter over the course of its life.
Yeah, and help us plan our cities as well, so they're not, you haven't got blocks of flats at the base of slopes that might be susceptible to seismic activity as well.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, I think we learnt a great deal from the Christchurch earthquakes in New Zealand a decade or so ago. I mean, that was an area of New Zealand that was considered to have low seismic hazard. And so although there was an earthquake code for that area, it wasn't as strict as the earthquake code in areas like Wellington, where we, you know, where we know that there's a high probability of a seismic event. And in fact, the earthquakes were not particularly high magnitude in that sequence, but they were shallow and they were almost directly under the city. And the central business district of the city was essentially destroyed by the earthquakes, not because buildings collapsed. There was a couple of really high profile cases of building collapses where building codes hadn't been followed. Most of the buildings stood up to the earthquake, but actually there was substantial ground failures, foundation failures through Christchurch, which meant that the tall buildings in the central business district had their foundations had failed, and although the buildings hadn't collapsed, they were no longer safe. And that presented a really interesting problem because, you know, for every tall building that there was, there had to be a kind of exclusion zone around it before it was taken down. And if you have 40 tall buildings, and therefore you have 40 exclusion zones around them, and, you know, because of the aftershock sequence, it wasn't safe or allowed people to go into the buildings to demolish them through explosives, so they all had to be dismantled externally. So the dismantling of the buildings took a couple of years. So it effectively, even though it was only a small proportion of the total buildings in the city centre that were in these conditions, it effectively meant that the city centre became a no-go area for a couple of years or so. So it was one of these things where it really hadn't been anticipated that the likely impact of an earthquake that hadn't been expected would be foundation failure.
Yeah, well, we're moving away from slopes and into my area of expertise into foundations, and piqued my interest. So what was the mechanism of failure? Was it a sheer failure of the piles, for instance?
It was largely liquefaction.
Right.
So there was an extensive liquefaction. The city centre of Christchurch is built on the banks of the River Avon. These were sort of fluvial deposits, and there was very, very extensive liquefaction through the whole of the city.
So it was actually a geotechnical failure of the piles. So they settled too much, which then led to a structural issue with the superstructure. Well, I think we've covered a huge amount of ground there, and it's certainly educated me a lot about slopes and served as a very timely reminder why we all need to do our bit on climate change and reduce our carbon emissions. So thank you to Dave, and I look forward to keeping in touch with your work. I know you've got a website which I'm sure you'd like to plug, the Landslide blog. Is that correct? Is there a .com?
If you just do a Google search for Landslide blog, it is the first thing that comes up. So it's a site that I've been running for about 15 years now, in which I just report, document, you know, interesting landslide events that occur around the world. It sits on the website of the American Geophysical Union. I write about things that I find interesting, and I hope that other people will find them interesting too. But I mean, I tend to write about either interesting research that's going on in landslides, or most of the time about interesting landslide events that are happening around the world.
Well, there's some amazing pictures on there, so do go and check it out, listeners. I think you'll enjoy it. Cheers, Dave.
Great. Thank you very much indeed.
I hope that you enjoyed that. We're going to be introducing a few new ideas to the podcast and how people interact with it over the next few months. We're also very keen to hear from anybody that's overseas and are comfortable coming onto the podcast as a guest. So do get in touch. You can find me on LinkedIn. Thanks. Bye-bye.